very happy to welcome you to this session in which we are very fortunate to have our brother Abdul Karim Suroosh. As many of you know, perhaps he is at the moment one of the leading intellectuals, definitely in Iran and perhaps in the Muslim world as a whole. He has already authored close to 40 books on a vast range of subjects. A lot of them of late have been dealing with questions which we here find of great interest and curiosity. These are questions dealing with freedom, pluralism, liberty, human rights, and so on, and how Muslims look upon these issues, or should begin to look at these issues and chart their way forward. One of the key advantages which Abdul Karim Suroosh has is that he has a fairly sound grounding in the religious sciences themselves, plus in modern philosophy, philosophy of science, and so on, so that he can draw upon the perspectives of different ways of looking at things without ignoring aspects which may enrich the debate. Although most of his writings are in Persian, which is his mother language, there are quite a number of translations of small pieces which are on his site, and also one major book which has been published by Oxford University Press on freedom, pluralism, and I don't know the title exactly, but that's a fairly 200 and something pages consisting of about 8 of his lectures on these subjects. Recently, for the last 2-3 years, he has been commuting between Tehran and the United States, and currently he is associate, I don't know what you call it, associate legal professor, visiting professor at Harvard University. Next semester he's going to teach a course on the study of the Quran. Whilst he is in London, he has been delivering lectures on Fridays in Persian on the subject of Islam and the challenge of modern times. And we have managed to persuade him to share these thoughts with us in English. So we would have the first lecture today, and inshallah, the next one on next Saturday. Now, without taking up much more,
inshallah,
it will be here, inshallah, if the Bahraini brothers agree to allow us to use the place. Or otherwise, we might have to take a vote and force you to do it. But, okay, so without, with this brief introduction, I leave it to Brother Suroosh to begin, and then at the end of it, we may take some other themes in the questions, inshallah.
Yes. Assalamu alaikum, sisters and brothers. Thank you, Brother Abbas, for your generous introduction. And thanks to all of you. Yes, as our brother Paul mentioned, this is going to be hopefully a trilogy, 3 sessions. Religion and the challenges of the modern world, or perhaps Islam and the challenges of the modern world. In the first session, that is the one we are in, I will dwell on the issue of religion and modernity, and then I will take up 2 main components of modernity, i.e. science and human rights, in order to examine their challenges, the challenges that they pose to the idea of religiosity, or more particularly to the teachings of Islam. So, I mean, needless to say that these are problems that we face today. And modernity is a kind of change that has happened in the history of mankind. And very briefly, speaking, religion usually deals with the unchangeable, immutable. And now the problem of problems for religious people, for scholars, is how to accommodate change into the unchangeable. So this is the format that we have to work in, and how we formulate the problem. But of course, it depends on the nature of the change that we are dealing with. The change sometimes comes from within, sometimes comes from without, sometimes comes from a philosophical background, sometimes from politics, and so on and so forth. So the nature of change also is very important. Today, of course, we are facing a particular change coming from West, i.e. the what we call it modernity. Modernity is a package, of course, and it contains a lot of things. I mean, it has got politics, it has got philosophy, it has got technology, science, rationality, and many other things. So when we talk about modernity, let us be mindful that we are talking about something which has got a lot of components, related components, of course. And so it is a package, it is a totality. Nevertheless, I mean, in the Muslim societies, some parts have become more prominent than others. But we take it as a totality, as I said. And to me, perhaps the most challenging ones nowadays, the ones that has so far created the most severe problems for us, are two main pillars of modernity, two main components. The rationality of the modernity, which is reflected in the modern science, modern empirical science, be it social or natural, and the issue of the idea of human rights, which altogether actually demonstrates a new paradigm that is prevailing in the modern time. So these two are the main topics for the next two sessions, inshallah. But as to this session, since we are going to talk about religion and the challenges of modernity, so we have got three main topics: religion, or perhaps Islam, if you like, and then modernity, and of course the challenges of modernity to religion. So we will postpone the challenges. We have to have a clear idea. At least, I have to tell you how I understand religion, how I understand modernity. Give a fair description, or possibly definition, of these two, in order to be aware of what we are comparing with what else. So this is the background that we need to have a clear idea about. Now, as to the religion itself, so we are either religious people or very familiar with a particular religion, so perhaps we do not need any definition. We know what it is. But, according to philosophers, according to social scientists, defining religion is next to impossible. It is a formidable task. It is absolutely, I would say, impossible. Because definitions are either a priori or a posteriori. Either you have the definitions before examining the facts, before examining the concrete cases, so that will be a priori definition. Or perhaps you choose to give the definition a posteriori, post talk after the facts and after examining the facts. Both ways actually fail in giving us a very workable even definition of religion, because there are a variety of religions in the world. There are religions which do not believe in any deity whatsoever, and there are religions which, of course, the idea of deity, the God, is pivotal to them. For us, for example, the idea of Allah is the most central idea in Islam, and without it, and the whole teachings of Islam will be null and nothing. But as you know, Buddhism, for example, is the example, the prominent example of religion, a very vast religion indeed, without any idea of deity, and consciously denying God, and having no recourse to this idea, and having no access to it, and actually have no belief in God whatsoever. Only a sort of experiential religion they have. Now, among the religions which believe in God, there are religions which are polytheist, have a number of God, and there are monotheism, and so on and so forth. We usually really do not know how we classify, for example, Christianity. Is it a polytheist religion? Is it a monotheist religion? I mean, now the scholars insist that it is monotheist, and this Trinity means three faces of the same God or whatever. In the past, of course, Trinity perhaps used to be taken more seriously, and so, as you know, it is a secret, it's a mystery in Christianity. But Judaism and Islam are very strictly monotheist, and do not accept any kind of polytheism whatsoever. So all in all, when you have all this in front of your eyes, and examples can be more than this, you will find that having a definition which can cover all these religions, whether Ebrahim or Muslim, is not possible. And that's why actually sociologists and philosophers now have virtually abandoned defining religion. And so we have to give a very, very general description of what religion might be. The tendency nowadays is towards defining or describing religion not on the basis of the teachings, on the outward teachings of religions, monotheism, polytheism, whatever, but on the esoteric experience of the religious people. Because after all, religion is based on some sort of belief, and beliefs are not taken from empirical facts, but from a sort of orientation, a mental, a spiritual orientation on the part of the believer towards reality, towards a kind of transcendence in reality. So the attitude of dependency, of feeling some holiness in the universe and something, that is a kind of what we call it, something which is common to all religions. I mean, heavenly, divine, or non-divine, something like that. Let us. This is not quite a new idea. I mean, if you look back into the Islamic culture in the past, at least among our mystics, we have the idea of shell and kernel. This is very familiar to our mystics, to the Urafa, as you know. Let us take of shell and kernel. I mean, in the case of religion, how do you put it in Arabic? Sa'id. No, shell and kernel. You see, you have got the kernel, of course, and that is the sparse. Yes, a lob wal qish. Yes, oh yes, quite. Yeah. You have got the lob, which is the kernel, and then you have got the qish, which is the shell. Now, we do not have this concept in the original teachings of religion. I definitely, it is not in Quran, certainly, and I do not remember any prophetic tradition whatsoever that mentions this. This is a gloss on the part of the scholars, of mystics especially, on the teaching of religion. They have come to the conclusion that we can classify the teachings of religion, the whole body of Islam, say, into two parts. The essential ones, if you like, that we call it the kernel, the lobe, and then we have got the shell, which is there around the kernel. Now this shell has got two different functions, which are very important. One is the function, it functions as a protective belt. You see, in order to preserve the kernel, you have to have something to preserve it, to keep it tight, intact, and let us say healthy, uncontaminated, in order to be conveyed to the later generations, the posterity, and so on. So there are, I mean, parts of Islam religion which functions as a shell in this particular sense. And then, of course, as you, I mean, might guess, I mean, there is a difference in value, a valuational difference between the shell and the kernel. The kernel is more important, so to speak, more valuable than the shell. Shell can be sacrificed at the doorstep of the kernel for the sake of the kernel. Sometimes we may forsake, we may abandon, we may sacrifice the shell. So both, I mean, it has got two different functions. First, it gives you a protective belt, and this is for the people who study religion. And then you know what to do with them, which is more important than the other. According to the same scholars, actually the shell, fiqh, is part of the shell. And even ethics, the morality, is part of the shell. I'm not saying that they are not important, but they are not as important as the kernel. Now the kernel here is something which is subject to interpretation. What is the kernel part of it? Now, according to the theologians of the Academy, the kernel consists of the main beliefs of Islam, believing in one God, believing in the prophet of the prophet, in the resurrection, in the afterlife, and so on and so forth. According to them, this is the kernel. This has to be preserved. And this is the essence of Islamicity, if you like. For a Muslim, in order to be Muslim, in order to abandon kufr and to come towards Islam, the belief in the prophethood of the prophet, in the oneness of God, in the resurrection is necessary, is incomplete. Without this you cannot call somebody a Muslim. So according to them, this is the God. The rest are shell. But according to these sticks, the kernel is the religious experience, the esoteric experience, the experience of God, of the transcendental unity of God, having a sort of relationship with Him, like the prophetic experience itself. You see, actually according to the mystics, following a prophet does not mean following his injunctions, following his orders only, does not mean that necessarily. It means following his experience, sharing his experience actually. Because before becoming a prophet, he did not have any official religion whatsoever. As far as we know from history, he was neither Christian nor Jew, nothing. Maybe he was a follower of Ibrahim, but that is a very vague idea. You see, he was a Hanif. But what he had and what made him a prophet was his experience. He used to go to Hara cave, as you know, for many years. And so he used to spend his time contemplating and meditating in that. And that was, I mean, because of that, that during the month of Ramadan, he received the first revelation and he discovered a new reality, a transcendental reality. And he became a prophet. And then actually his religion, i.e. Islam, did an expansion on the experience that he had in that cave. An expansion on the experience that he had. lofty image of the personality of the Prophet himself. So, so to speak, expanded himself into a religion, into a civilization. But the journey and the beginning of that experience actually took place when he used to go to the cave to meditate and to contemplate and to have the religious experience. So, the kernel, now I am emphasizing the fact that the kernel is the experience and the beliefs and the theological beliefs are the kind of explanation, epistemological explanation, which is being really imposed on that experience. And then, in order to preserve the experience, in order to preserve the beliefs, the theological beliefs, you need a kind of shell which functions as a protective belt. Therefore, you, let us say, forge or advocate or create a sort of protective belt, i.e. you need a morality and then you need a kind of law. In such a space, in such an atmosphere, the religious experience is reproducible, repeatable. This is very important. Every prophet actually needs his religion to be, I mean, conveyed, and his teachings and his experience to be conveyed to the posterity, to later generations. And for this, he has to provide the atmosphere in which religious experience can flourish, can be reproduced, can be conveyed to others. So, actually, in a non-religious or in a non-pious atmosphere, if you like, the religious experience usually is not taken. It's very, very hard to come by. So we need such a medium in order to have such an experience. This actually helps us. This brief description of the shell and the kernel of religion and religiosity help us to know and to judge which society is more religious. Now, as you know, I mean, we have got this question in front of us. Are we living in a more religious age than the previous one? Was the medieval, era, the inhabitants of the medieval era, more religious than the people, the inhabitants of the modern age? Are people now more irreligious, more anti-religious? Usually this is the common judgment, that through modernity people have become more irreligious and they have abandoned their beliefs, their practice, their experience and whatsoever. In Iran, for example, we have got the same debate, you see, among the intellectuals, among the scholars. Are our youngsters now more religious than before? Has the Islamic revolution helped youngsters to become more religious, more attentive to religious practice? Are they firmer and more established in their beliefs, or perhaps they are not like that? So what is the criterion, really, in order to decide? What is the criteria? If you take the practicing of, you see, of the ahkam, of the rulings of faith, I mean, apparently we have to come to the conclusion that people have become more negligent, isn't it? And in the past, I mean, as far as we know, as far as the books of history show us, I mean, people were very, very much more interested in practicing, and the appearance and on the surface the Islamic societies, during the month of Ramadan, mosques were full, the Jum'ah prayers people usually used to attend, and so on and so forth. When you compare it with the modern time, of course, you will definitely see and notice a decline. So is this the right criterion to use? Is the practice, is the liveliness of the shell, so to speak, the presence of the shell, is a good criterion to say that to decide whether we have got a better or a more religious society or not. The criterion that I go by and I take it as the main criterion, since we are going to deal with the challenges of modernity to religion, therefore we have to see what sort of challenge is there and what modernity will do with each part of religion, with the share of eternity. Now, as far as I understand, I would like to persuade you, perhaps, to think about it, is that religiosity is not to be gauged on the practicing of religion, with praying, with fasting, and so on.
Observance,
yes. I'm not saying that these have nothing to do with Islam or religiosity. I am not talking about the criteria. Because you can have all this by force. You can have all this through taqlid, emulation, blind emulation, as it is the case in most of the religious societies, among most of the people. They usually do not know. I am not saying that this has got no benefit, this is not useful, that is not what I'm saying. It has got its own functions. I mean, people to say prayers, to fast during the Ramadan, he doesn't know what they are doing. But as a criterion, you cannot use it as observance of the world. Because as I said, it can lead you to a blind emulation, which is usually the case, and it can be made by force. For example, in Iran, now we have got hijab, okay, among the women. This is by force. I mean, if they let people free, women free, maybe 90% of women will take hijab. They believe in Islam and they do it themselves. A few percent, 5%, 10%, they do not like it. But now, of course, it is a lagging law in Iran and it has to be observed by any lady whatsoever. And, for example, abstaining from drinking wine. Okay, but that is again one of the rules of Sharia. It has to be observed. But could it be taken as criterion for the religiosity of a particular society? That is the question. You can, outlaw, declare it illegal, to drink wine. Okay, and therefore you may not encounter any case of drinking. But that does not mean that people are more religious. Law is law. Let us know it. Law is law. That means if you do not observe it, you will be punished. And because of that, you have to observe it and you obey it, per force or maybe voluntarily. But law is law. And as you know, even according to the teachings of religion, action depends on the need, on the intention. If the intention is different, action is absolutely different and has got a different value. If you do not drink, not because you are a Muslim, but because you are under force of the government. If you take hijab, not because of the you are Muslim or you believe in hijab, but because of the force of the government, and so on and so forth. The intention actually dictates the action, and the intention tells us what the action is, and the spirit and the essence of the action constitutes the spirit of the action. Anyway, shams are like the law for the society, and law can be different. And people may obey the law not because they like it or they believe in it, but because they fear from the punishment. So that cannot be taken as a criterion for the religiosity. Though we know that in the past people were perhaps practicing better than the present, but that should not be taken. You see, for example, Imam Ghazali. He has written a whole 8-volume book on the Ihya Ulum al-Din. philosophy, the revival of the religious sciences. He is a grand mufti from the 5th century, okay? An Iranian, a theologian, a mystic, a faqih, and really his credentials are more than to be mentioned here. But at the end, he was a professor in Nizami in Baghdad, and he was himself a pupil of Imam Al-Harami al-Khomeini, and then he became, as I said, a master of theology and fiqh in Nizami in Baghdad, and he trained many students and so on. But he was a very... When he was 38, young enough, when he was 38, before he became 40, this is the age of change. And those of you who are about 40, so you're to despair, because no change would ever happen to you. But those who are below 40, so you must be very thoughtful and very mindful. And this I say very seriously, actually. And those who really want a change, and a change has to happen in the life of the individual, that usually comes when you are under 40. And these big changes, such as the changes took place in the heart and the soul of Ghazali, or even Rumi, Mawlawi, he was also 38. And as you know, the Prophet also was 38, according to some records. Or according to some other record, he was 40. But anyway, that is the time of change. And if you go above that, then, as you say, it is hopeless altogether. Now, pardon?
Don't try with us. We have the
No, but they are youngsters here among the audience. This is not addressed to you. I mean, ladies usually never get over 40, so that is for sure. I mean, he was 38, and as you know, he was taken by a very serious experience. He actually challenged himself very, very severely, and the challenge is there, and he has recorded it, and reported it to us in his book, Al-Munqidhu Min Al-Talaq. Those of you who read Arabic or English or French, whichever, because the book now is in English, in French, and the original is in Arabic, the deliverance from misguidedness, something like Munqidhu Min Al-Talaq. So he tells us the book is one of the final books that he has written when he was maybe 53, 54, because he lived only 55 years. And so he tells us the story of his intellectual life, if you like, his autobiography. And he says that for a whole 6 months he was ill, he was sick, challenging himself. He said that doctors and physicians used to come to me, to cure me, to treat me. They did not know my real illness. I was aware of what was going on in my heart, in my mind. The main question was this for him: am I a religious man? Is this the religious life that I am living in? That was really his main question. And since he was a sensitive voice and he took it seriously, this kind of question usually come to mind during the life of every individual. But we usually do not, we ignore them, we do not pay much attention to them. He was serious and sensitive enough to take the question seriously. He was, I mean, with all means, a very, very happy man. He was a professor, he was very close to Khilafat, to the Sultan, he was very wealthy, he was very knowledgeable, and he was praised by the students, the scholars of his age. He had very good students, he had very good masters and teachers. So, I mean, in every respect, and by any standard, any criterion, he was a prominent, a very happy, lucky man. And none of these actually satisfied me. And none of these actually were the answer to this question: was his life a religious way of living, teaching fiqh, teaching kalam, theology, and teaching usul al-fiqh, living in a so-called or apparently a religious society, training students in fiqh and kalam, and helping the Khalifa and so on and so forth. None of these actually either answered this question. And finally, after 6 months illness, he decided to leave the place because he came to the conclusion that staying in Baghdad and having the same job and going to the Nizamiyya and teaching there and being in the same milieu among the same people, among the same students and teachers and so on, would be a mu'abbe. And solve his problem. So, I mean, in disguise, but everybody knew him, though he did not live in the age of pictures, images, and information. Nevertheless, people knew him. He was a very reputable man. So in disguise, actually, he left Baghdad to Syria, and he stayed there for about 10 years in order to rebuild his personality, to revise his mind and the content of his mind, and really to challenge himself, to criticize himself, and to reach the clear conclusion that what was the correct way of leading and living a religious life. So he wrote. I mean, actually, he put all his experience in this book, which is his magnum opus, the Ihya ul-Ulum al-Din, the revivification, revival of religious sciences. The story of the book is very lengthy. What is relevant to our discussion is this, that he, one of the main conclusions that he came to was this, that fiqh, the ilm al-fiqh, is actually suffocating the whole religious sciences. That is one of his main ideas. That putting more and much emphasis on fiqh not only does not revive Islam, does not give a new life to Islam, but on the contrary, will lead to its suffocation, its death. And in order to revive it, in order to give it a revival, one has to perhaps rescue it, you see, from the hands and the claws of fiqh, if you like. So that was really what he did. And that is the main message of his Ihya ul-Ulum al-Din. There actually he says, he mentions, and he admits that the schools of fiqh is flourishing everywhere in the whole Islamic civilization, all over the Islamic civilization. And he does not take it as a criterion for the religiosity of the people of his time. You see? He doesn't take it, though he is one of the fuqaha himself. He was one of the professors of the fiqh in the Nizamiyya Baghdad, and he did a lot, and he wrote a lot about this. Nevertheless, quite sincerely, he came to the remarkable conclusion that that was not a sign of the life of Islam. On the contrary, it was an evidence, an indication that perhaps Islam as a whole was experiencing death under the weight of fiqh, under the weight of the fuqaha. You know, the whole book, in every corner of the book, actually, you will find how to put it, the kind of hostility towards fiqh. He was not hostile towards fiqh. He was a mufti himself. He was a practicing. He was a man of piety, of bara, you know, of soap, of asceticism, and everything. I mean, nevertheless, he did not take the fiqh as the main criterion. So this is not a conclusion. That's what I'm I would like to say and to hammer home. That this is not something that is new. I mean, from the time of Ghazali, at least 9 centuries ago, you have got the same thing, and the flourishing of fiqh never has been taken as a sign of religiosity. Actually, Ghazali has got his own arguments in this favor, and his arguments are quite interesting, and he wants us to listen to him. He was not an outsider. He has got arguments both against theology and also against death. And somewhere in his theology, he tells us that please take this advice freely. Freely, that's what he says, from someone who has reached the, the height or the peak of faith or the peak of kalam. Yes, that's what he says. He says, I'm no insider, outsider, I am not a beginner, I am not a youngster, I'm not an outlandish or something. I am from among faith and kalam, and I have examined it page by page. So please take it freely. فَقْبَلِ النَّسِيحَةَ مَجَّانًا. That is what he says. مَمَّنْ بَلَغَ أَقْصَى دَرَجَةِ الْمُتَكَلِّمِينَ. So you may take it as praising himself. But actually he's not praising himself. He says, I have reached the peak of kalam, of faith. So I advise you, I give you this piece of advice freely, in order not to repeat the same experience, not to fall in the same pitfall as I fell. And beware and be mindful of what you are doing. So this is very important. And Ghazali, I take him, he had many followers after him. Now, for him, actually, the essence of religion was two things. So he described the faith as shell, as something contingent, really, as something accidental, I would say. He doesn't use the word accidental, but this is there, actually. The word may be mine. I use the word accidental and essential, but what he uses, actually, is this, that faith is something contingent. In the sense that he says that it is not a necessary part of religion, any religion, including Islam. It could have been otherwise. And had the people lived in a different manner. First of all, he says that if there was justice, we had no need to fear Muslim. That's because people behave, not on the basis of justice, unjustly they behave. There is a very good sentence by him, again in the Hiyar al-Muddin, he says that وَلَوْ تَنَاظَلُوهَا بِالْعَدْلِ, in the life of faith, وَلَوْ تَنَاظَلُوهَا بِالْعَدْلِ, لَتَعَطَّلَ الْفُقَهَا. That is what he said. If people behaved justly, then the fuqaha would become darkness. That is what he said. Really, that is what he said exactly. In the literal translation, he said, we are here as fuqaha because people are unjust. That is what he means by contingent. There is a condition that necessitates the existence or the presence of fuqaha. And if that condition does not hold, then the fuqaha will become darkness. And there would be no need to their presence. And this is exactly the argument that one uses for the necessity, in order to prove the necessity of law. After all, if people are just enough, then there will be no need for law. People are already mature and just and need no law. But since we know that most of the people do not behave justly, do not observe justice, then we need a law, we need punishment, we need this and that. Okay? So, and this actually applies to Sharia law, which we call it fiqh. Therefore, actually, what he says is this, that fiqh is a worldly, you call it, temporal science. It is not something that belongs to religion per se. And fuqaha, he called them ulama ud-dunya. They are not ulama ud-deen. Yes, he's very explicit on this. He said they are worldly scientists. They are scientists, very good, but for their life in this world, not for the next one. Because according to him, this I mention it to you, rather extensively, because this comes from a very grand mufti, a grand faqih. This, again, this is not something which some modern intellectuals have fabricated in order to discredit faith. It is not the case. It is interesting to know. What he says is this, that faith is a worldly affair, the worldly science. It is not, a religious science per se. Why? He has got many arguments in favor of his claim. One of the arguments runs like this. He says that we know, and all Fuqaha agree, that when Muslims actually attack a country, a society, and they invite people to become Muslims, this is the idea of jihad, of course. That is in fact every faqih has written that it is the right or the duty of Muslims to stop and to attack the non-believing society in order to either force them to become Muslims or to invite them to become Muslims, or if they do not accept to become Muslims, either they have to pay something, jizya they call it, or if they choose to stay as non-believers, then they will be killed. That is the case. This is in the Shi'i faith and this is in the Sunni faith. No misgiving. And very clear. So we have got in some of the du'as, نَقَوْمًا آمَنُوا بِكَ لِيَحْقِنُوا بِهِ دِمَاءَهُمْ فَأَدْرَكُوا مَا أَمَّنُوا وَنَحْنَا آمَنَّا بِكَ بِأَلْسِنَتِنَا وَقُلُوبِنَا لِتَغْفِرَ لَنَا. You see, this is in the Imam Sajjad's book. He says, oh God, some people actually, declare belief or declare faith in order to preserve their blood, their life. That was the case. Now, Ghazali argues that you see that Islam, even under the sword, Islam تحت ظلال السيوف, is acceptable. But this is not an Islam which can save you in the hereafter. You may become a Muslim in this world, and a faqih will consider you as a Muslim. You will be tahir then, you can have marriage with Muslim girls, and all these things will be observed about you. You will become part of the Muslim society, part of the Islam society, a member of the community of Muslims, according to faqh. But this is not a religion that can say, can help you in the hereafter. This will not actually rescue you from fire and so on and so forth. This is what Ghazali, that's what he said, that faith only deals with the apparent conditions and has got nothing to do with the heart, with the intention, and with the inward, you see, dealings of the Muslims. Again, he has got a very good sentence in his book, the Hiya'ul-Midina. He says, Al-Qalbu Kharijun an Wilayat al-Faqih. Exactly. Heart is beyond the authority of Faqih. Fuqaha has got no authority on the mind or on the heart of the people. They have got only the authority on their bodies. That's why he said that Fiqh is a worldly science. And Fuqaha al-Ulama al-Dunya, because their territory is only the body of the believers, neither the mind nor the heart. That is one reason. And then he said that in fiqh you have got tricks. Actually, kalam ilm al-jadal, wal fiqh ilm al-hiyal. Okay. Fiqh is the science of tricks. And this is true. This is very true indeed. The more you become, well-versed in fiqh, the better you have the mastery over fiqh and tricks in fiqh. This is like all legal affairs. If you are very powerful in law, you will become a better barrister in the court. In order to change something, in order to reverse the judgment, in order to favor, or in order to commute, or whatever. So that, according to him, shows the worldly characteristic, character of faith. Okay. So let me actually finish this particular argument here. This was just in order to bring home to you that faith, or the practice of faith, or the presence of the shell, if you like, among the Muslims by no means can be considered the criterion of religiosity. That is nothing. When you look into the affair very carefully, be it prayer, fasting, hijab, drinking or not drinking, and whatever. Now, according to Ghazali, akhlaq, I mean morality, is the more important part of religion. And that's what he said. This is really very important, apart from the challenges that modernity puts to religion. And from an insider's perspective, really we have to look into this much more carefully, take it more seriously. One of the problems, one of the plights, calamities of the Muslim societies nowadays is the cleavage, the divergence between ethics and fiqh. We see it now in our society in Iran. I say it from my first-hand experience there. Because of the prominence, of dominance of fiqh, morality has become weaker and weaker. And on the top of all morality lies justice, as you know. Justice is the mother of all virtues in ethics. Now, since fuqaha usually think that fiqh is the embodiment of justice, fiqh is the embodiment of morality, that is what they think. If you practice fiqh, you will have already the justice and morality there. That is how they think. And this cleavage, actually, this divergence, tells us a lot, not only about our present, our current situation, but also about the whole history of the trajectory, if you like, of the Islam civilization. This cleavage has become more and more. And this was an illness that Ghazali diagnosed in his age, 900 years ago, that unfortunately he said that كل علوم الدين مات إلا ضعفت إلا تصفف فإنه مات بالكلية. That is what he says. So he was a Sufi. He says all the science, religious sciences now are the weakest, except tasawwuf, because he's completely dead. Now, Ghazali diagnosed the disease, and he was very right on this particular thing, and we have still the problems with this. We have got it. And under the dominance and the prominence of the fiqh, what we lose actually is the morality. You see, most of the people, this is something that we have to say to ourselves, and we have to have it among us, that we have to know it. Most of the people who perhaps are good observers of fasting, of praying, they lie very, very fluently. Very fluently. They actually make labor, they actually, all these sort of things. Let us not take it as a blame. Let us look at it epistemologically and sociologically. What is the cause of the reason behind? Why our morality is so weak, even among the people who observe the fiqh very strictly? When they go to Hajj, you see, they are very strict. I mean, in throwing stones, in this, and then they ask all sorts of questions, minute things, from the akhunds that they are with them, in order not to fail in any of them. But when it comes to talking, to lying, to this, they are very easygoing about these things, very easygoing. And as you know, I mean, this is heart of the mission of the Prophet. Nowhere actually Prophet said that I am here, I am a prophet in order to make you observe the fair rules. Though he was himself actually the man who established fair, but he never said that this constituted the heart of his mission. The heart of his mission was the Utamula Makarama Akhlaq, in order to establish morality and ethics among you. That was the heart of his mission. But most unfortunately, this is the weakest among us. We pay no attention to it whatsoever. And that was also something that Ghazali diagnosed and told us and wrote about it extensively, and is still with us. Ihya ulum al-Din, according to him, the reunification of the Buddhist cells, according to him, is totally vile moronic. And actually the whole book, the eighth volume of our Lugatine, is about Islamic ethics. Islamic ethics. Not based on the scholarly writings of his predecessors, of course, because he was not an emulator, he was himself a scholar, so based on his own experience. His own experience, and that's what makes the book so interesting to read about. So let us come to the conclusion tentatively that morality is much more important than that. And if we would like to choose a criteria in order to decide which society is more religious, let us look at the observing developments on the observing of the moral rules. Here you find religion more present, if you like, than in fact and in practicing. a society in which 90% of the marriages lead to divorce is a fiqhi society, because people marry on the basis of fiqh and then get divorced on the basis of fiqh. So being an observing fiqh does not necessarily give you a healthy society. Does not necessarily give you a healthy society. Now getting married on the basis of fiqh, getting divorced on the basis of fiqh, means practicing fiqh, but does not mean a healthy society. A society in which 90% of the people whose hand have been cut, okay, that is something which a society in which fiqh has been strictly applied. Thieves have been taken to punishment and then they have their hands cut. But this is not a healthy society. So observing fiqh rules does not necessarily give you a good society, healthy society. So all these are arguments in favor of that claim. So let us take morality as something which fare better in this respect. Now, morality again, especially among, according to the Ash'aris in Islam, in itself is, does not carry, if you like, its own virtue, its own value, its own shoulders. It is there for something else. It is not there for itself per se. The objectivity of the good and bad among most of the Muslim Mukallameen is not acceptable. They do not think that morality, saying truth, telling truth is good because of itself. They think that it serves another purpose. And because of that, we take it as a valuable, as a praiseworthy action. It means that if lying to if lying serves the same purpose, then lying will be good in place of telling the truth, and so on and so forth. This is actually a complicated argument, debate among the philosophers of ethics. But anyway, morality is important, but not for the sake of itself, because it is servant. It serves another purpose. Now, what is that purpose? This is again important. For Ghazali and for many people who think like me, morality is important, is religious, is essential to religious life, because it provides the background for religious experience. It purifies you. It purifies you in order to give you a condition to your soul in order to be able to encounter the transcendence of reality. So that is the of morality, of course, is twofold. And for having a healthy society needs morality. Having a calm life, having a trustable relationship with others, and so on and so on. You need morality. It has got a social function, no doubt about it. But that does not conclude the function of morality. You need it, especially in a religious framework, for another purpose. And that is giving you, I mean personally, individually, a kind of spirituality that enables you to encounter the transcendental reality, and i.e. to make you ready and prepare to have a kind of religious experience. That function is the more important function of morality. For a man who lies a lot, for a man who does not observe morality, I mean, virtually having such a religious experience is impossible. So again, we come to the same end, to the same conclusion, that religious experience is the heart of religiosity, and the life of religion is dependent on the life of the religion. So, actually, this is half of what I have in mind to say here, but I think now the time is up, and it's your time now to put forward your observations. The conclusion that I would like to draw is this, that in order to see what modernity is going to do with religion, in order to see and to calculate and to gauge what modernity is going to do for or against religion, whichever you take, in order to see that, we have to see what modernity is to do for or against religious experience. That is the main conclusion that I am going to draw from what I see. Because there are people who think that since in the modern time people usually do not observe their religious duties, since, or perhaps, I mean, on the other hand, when they want to make compatible modernity with religion, let us move on this direction. When they want to talk or to do something in order to make modernity and religion or Islam compatible, what comes to their mind first and foremost is this: how are we to practice or to observe or affair in the modern society? If we go to the pole, for example, to the North Pole, the South Pole, how can we calculate the time of prayer and how are we, in which direction do we go? If we go to the moon, for example, and these kind of things now are there in the world. If we go to the moon, how are we to practice our mantra? Can we make a tayammum, for example, on the moon earth, or perhaps the soil of the moon is not suitable for making tayammum, and so on and so on. What are we to do? I mean, is the moon year, I mean, can be taken as a year for paying zakat or paying homes and these sort of things? They put these questions to the fuqaha, and they think that these are the challenges of modernity. Modernity challenges faith, and in order to answer and to push back the challenges of modernity, we need fuqaha to answer our questions. We go to them and we ask them this masail: how to pray in moon, how to direct or orient ourselves towards Kaaba when we are in the moon or in the pole, and this and that. For them, solving the problem or the challenges of modernity religion is so easy, because they have taken the faith as the main face, as the main dimension of religion, and because of that they confine or reduce the whole challenges into the challenge of modernity and faith. And the fuqaha are the people who are there in order to solve the problem and answer the questions. And they actually are very proud of what they are doing. Because I know, for example, in Iran, there was seminar after seminar about the modern problems of medicine. And you know what they did? They invited Fuqaha to go to their seminar. And really, I was surprised, I was shocked. They had no idea about the medical ethics. They had no idea about the assumptions of the modern medicine. Nothing about it. They pre-assumption about human body, about human soul, about human individuality. Nothing of that kind. What they had in mind, I mean our physicians, our practicing physicians, our pious physicians in Iran, what they had in mind is this, that the modern practice of medicine, I mean, puts some fiqhi problems to us. And in order to solve them, we need fuqaha. So the challenges of the modern time will be solved with the aid and the help of fuqaha, and that will be, I mean, solved. So I mean, yes, I mean, if you take religion, or perhaps the most important part of Parmeshwar religion as fiqh, then the challenges of modernity to fiqh can be solved by fuqaha, and virtually, I mean, we can be very now comfortable, because these problems are easily solved by fuqaha. So you can live in a non-Islamic society, a non-Islamic milieu, and even in outside the planet Earth, and be a Muslim, and do not bother about the challenge of modernity. But if we go further back, dig deeper into the question, then we will reach, we'll come to the worldview, to the religious experience, to the essential beliefs, to the morality, and the challenges there are much more serious than the challenges to the observing of rules of faith. So this brings me to the end of the first part of my lecture this evening. Unfortunately, I think I better stop here and give the chance to the floor to put forward the information, the observations. Inshallah, for the next time, we will follow the next. Thank you very much.
Start or? So we break for prayer or?